Without God, you can't say that it's objectively good to love people and objectively bad to murder them. Interesting when atheists are coming up and saying, well, we're getting better. What they're doing is they're stealing a standard from God in order to even say that. Well, there's no evidence for God. It turns out that when atheists say this, they're assuming that the world should be orderly and that our minds should be able to detect an orderly world. Right? That we ought to be able to gather evidence and draw valid conclusions about reality outside of our skulls. Right? That's what they're assuming.
I am Brady Blevins, and welcome back to Apologetics Profile Podcast. We're a ministry and work of Watchman Fellowship. You can visit us at watchman.org. That's Watchman with an A. And today we have a friend of mine, a guy I've known for, I was thinking about this, it's either 6 or 7 years, something like that. We first met at a conference here in Arlington, Texas, where Watchman is headquartered. We were at the same conference, and from there we sprung a friendship, and I've definitely been a partaker of his ministry for some time, and it's my pleasure to have Dr. Frank Turek on the podcast with us today. Welcome, Frank.
Brady, great being with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, do you want to tell us just a little bit about your ministry?
Yeah, crossexamine.org we created back in about 2006 to largely go to college campuses to present the evidence that Christianity is true based on a book I co-authored with Dr. Norman Geisler called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. Since then, it's expanded not just to colleges, but we go to high schools, we go to churches, we're all over the internet, as you know. I have a great social media team here that gets all the word out on, you know, Instagram and Facebook and YouTube and Twitter, our YouTube channel. We put a lot of Q&A from the college campuses, or is it Campi, Brady? I know. Anyway, the college campuses, we have a lot of questions from young people, and we put the Q&A from that up on our YouTube channel, the Cross-Examine YouTube channel. So there's more than 1,000 videos up there, so people can get short answers to these tough questions. We also are on radio, the American Family Radio Network. We have a podcast called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. We have a TV show on the NRB Network called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. And so that's the kind of work we do. Similar to you, you're doing more of the work with cults and aberrant religions. You're pointing out, which is really needs to be pointed out, where these other faiths have errors or go wrong. We're trying to show on the other side why Christianity is true. That's really kind of our niche. But everything is necessary in today's modern world. You know, you can get so much information over the internet now that now the idea that we have to point out where certain people have gone wrong is even more necessary now because so much of their wrong teaching is available to kids right off their magic rectangular squares or rectangular glowing phones, as you know. So you really have to have a positive case and also point out where people have gone astray.
Absolutely. I mean, it's in the college campus is a tough place, and I appreciate your ministry and so much of what you've done because, like, I know our office here in Arlington is I mean, literally just, you know, a tenth of a mile away from the campus of the University of Texas in Arlington. And of course, atheism, I guess, is probably what you'd say is king in terms of the worldview that's being taught. But, you know, you have groups like ICC and the World Mission Society Church of God in just aggressively going after young people. And they say, you know, hey, we're Christian, and man, we want to just help you study the Bible. And for a lot of unsuspecting Christian students, the next thing that you know, they get swept in. And so, yeah, you're absolutely right. We need it on both sides for sure.
That's right.
So, well, today what I want to do is I want to look at some common objections, and this will be a two-part episode, and so we're not going to go through all of them today. But I want to go through some objections that they're not necessarily the run-of-the-mill objections that we've heard you know, answered 100 times before. But these are common objectives I'm noticing are coming up more and more and more as time passes by. And so I'm just going to kind of hit right to the list here, Frank.
Okay.
One of the ones I've heard people say is that society is getting better. That there's fewer wars going on around the world per capita than there ever has been before. So this is maybe like the most peaceful time in human history, a lot of people have said. We've made strides towards equality. And all of this is just evidence that we don't need God to be good. What would you say to that?
Well, all that presupposes a standard. In order to say that you're getting better, you have to know what best is, because if you don't know what best is, you can't say you're getting closer to the best or further away from the best. In other words, you can't say you're getting better or worse unless you know what the standard is. So the question is, what is the standard? If there is no God, there is no standard, no objective standard anyway. We can come up with our own standards, but without God, you can't say that it's objectively good to love people and objectively bad to murder them. You see, that's why I find it interesting when atheists are coming up and saying, well, we're getting better. What they're doing is they're stealing a standard from God in order to even say that. And first of all, you'd have to examine whether or not it's true. I don't know if their claim that we're getting better or more equal, let's say, whatever that means. You have to ask, what do you mean by more equal? Because that, first of all, that assumes that we ought to all be equal. Why should people be equal if there's no God? Why shouldn't you just use your power to suppress other people and get what you want if there's no standard beyond you which says that's wrong? So again, they're presupposing a standard of God, or a standard of good, I should say, and that presupposes God. Now, with regard to wars, you hear this quite a lot. The atheists will say things like, well, religion is the cause of most wars. Yeah. Well, that's demonstrably false. Even the Encyclopedia of War put out not long ago that less than, or I should say fewer than 7% of all wars throughout history, and I think they've documented over 1,500 wars, have been caused primarily by religion. Most of them have to do with socioeconomic or political reasons. Very few have to do with religion. And by the way, if you take Islam out of that, the number drops down to 3%. As we know, there's a strain of Islam, particularly taken right from the Quran, Surahs 8 and 9, that you ought to make war against the infidel, and anyone who's a non-Muslim is an infidel. So more than half of the wars caused by religion are caused by Islam, or primarily caused by Islam. And of all the wars out there, fewer than 7% are caused by religion. So that objection, A, assumes a standard, and B, I don't even know if it's true that there are fewer wars now than in the past. But even if it's true, again, they're assuming a standard.
Exactly. I've wondered that too. So they're stealing from God. Frank, that would be a great book title, don't you think?
Yes, thanks. Thanks for that. Gee, I just wrote it as we're sitting here. It's called Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case. And that's one of the chapters in there is morality. Because atheists will, and whenever they say, in fact, whenever anyone says this is better or worse, or this is beneficial or not beneficial, or this is good and this is bad, they're all presupposing a standard, and that standard does not exist in an objective sense unless God exists. Otherwise, it's just their opinion. I think part of that objection too had to say we can be good without God, and the answer to that is yes, you can be good without God. You don't need to believe in God to be good, but God must exist in order for good to exist at all. That's really the point. Yeah. We're not saying that atheists don't know right from wrong. We're not saying that atheists can't do right. What we're saying is there is no right, there is no good, there is no right way to live or wrong way to live unless God exists. So the argument isn't about whether or not we can be good. The argument is really, what is good if there's no God? And without God, you can't define that, not in an objective way. It would be just, say, your opinion against Hitler's opinion. Hitler thought good was killing all the undesirable so he can create the Uber race, right?
Yeah.
And we're saying, no, these are human beings made in the likeness and image of God. Don't kill them. Love them. Without God, you can't say that you're right and Hitler's wrong.
Exactly. Very good. Now, I've heard some people say there's no way to know that the Bible really came from God. I mean, after all, the writers could have just made it up.
Yeah, well, I would ask them, what do you mean they made it up? How did they do that? What motive would they have to do that? Mm-hmm. You know, you and I have a mutual friend, J. Warner Wallace, the cold case homicide detective, who says whenever he finds a dead body that he knows has been murdered, he says there's only three reasons why that guy's dead. Not a thousand reasons. There's just three, or a combination of the three. There was either a sex issue, a money issue, or a power issue. Sex, money, or power. Those are the three great motivators that cause people or influence people to sin. Now, sex, money, and power are good things. The problem is they're so good that oftentimes we'll take shortcuts to get them.
Yeah.
And so whenever Jim is trying to investigate the motive of a crime, he looks for those three motives. The same thing is true with a conspiracy. What basically people are saying here is that these Jews who thought they were God's chosen people. In fact, let me back up for a second here, Brady. What's so important to recognize is that all the writers of the New Testament, with the exception of Luke, all the writers of the New Testament were Old Testament believing Jews who thought Yahweh was God and they thought they were God's chosen people, right? Mm-hmm. Luke is the only Gentile. Everyone else is an Old Testament believing Jew.
Yeah.
The question is, what motive would they have to invent a resurrected Jesus? Keep in mind, as Jews, they didn't believe somebody could be God, a human being could be God. They thought that was blasphemy. And second, they didn't believe that somebody in the middle of time could resurrect from the dead. They thought somebody at the end of time could, but not the middle of time. So the question is, what motive would they have had to invent this resurrected Jesus, right? They didn't get sex for it. They didn't get real popular with the ladies for saying Jesus rose from the dead, right? They didn't get money for it. They're not 21st century prosperity gospel preachers, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. And number three, they did not get power. In fact, they got the opposite. They got persecuted. Paul had power as a Jew persecuting Christians, but he lost all that power and got persecuted himself by saying that Jesus had resurrected from the dead. So the point here is, if you're going to say that the New Testament writers made it up, first of all, I want to ask you, what evidence do you have for that? And secondly, what motive would they have had to make it up? Because by saying it was true, they got excommunicated from the synagogue, and then they got beaten, tortured, and killed. Last time I checked, that was not a list of perks, right? You don't start religions that you know are false, that will get you kicked out of your chosen people club, and then beaten, tortured, and killed. Exactly. There's no motive to make it up. In fact, one last thing I want to say on it, because this is often missed, I think. In fact, Christians miss this. And it's going to sound heretical for a minute, but it's not. Just stick with me. The reason that Christianity is true is not because a series of documents we put under one binding we call the Bible says it's true. In fact, Christianity would be true if the Bible never existed. Mm-hmm. Say why? Because Christianity did not originate with a book. It originated with an event, the event known as the resurrection. There would be no book, a series of books written by first century New Testament or first century Jews who wrote the New Testament. There would be none of those works from first century Jews unless Jesus rose from the dead.
Exactly.
See, the New Testament writers did not create the resurrection. The resurrection created the New Testament writers. The Christianity originated with an event, the resurrection. It didn't originate with a book. Now, thankfully, they wrote it down later so we could know about it and orient our lives toward it. But the idea that Christianity originated with a book and it's all based on a book is false. It originated with an event. There were thousands of Christians, Brady, as you know, before a line of the New Testament was ever written.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, why? Because they witnessed the resurrected Jesus, not because they read a book somewhere.
Yep.
So the person that claims that this was all invented has a big, big burden. And the other thing, which we don't have time to talk about in depth here, but try and invent a character like Jesus. Nobody has ever invented one in fiction or nonfiction because, well, it's nonfiction would be true. No one's ever invented a character like Jesus. He's unique in all of history.
Yeah.
So they couldn't have invented it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, sometimes people come back and say, well, okay, you know, men make mistakes. Therefore, how can we trust the Bible because it was written by men?
I would say, are you a man? And they'd have to say yes, or a woman, whatever, right? Although now that's debatable, right? Okay, people make mistakes, they'll say. Well, that's true. But you're a person. Did you just make a mistake saying that?
Yeah.
Right? In other words, it's self-defeating to say that since someone said something, you can't believe it because people make mistakes. If that were the case, you couldn't believe that statement either. It is true that people make mistakes, but it's not true that people always make mistakes.
Exactly.
In fact, you know, there's a lot of inerrant books out there. It's not just the Bible. Mm-hmm. I mean, most kids' books are inerrant, right? There's not enough room to make errors, you know.
Yeah.
See, socks run, 2 + 2 equals 4, right?
Yeah.
Those books are inerrant. Hopefully there's some books behind you that are not, and behind me that are not the Bible, but they're still inerrant. There's no errors in them, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we can do inerrant things all the time. Now, you don't need inerrancy to show that the Bible's true. Inerrancy is a conclusion, it's not a premise.
Mm-hmm.
But even if there were mistakes in the Bible, that wouldn't mean that Christianity's false.
Yeah.
I don't think there are, don't get me wrong.
Sure.
But just like if you go to, say, to the ESPN website and you look up a box score from last night's baseball game and you realize there's a mistake in the box score, that wouldn't mean that everything you read on the ESPN website is false,
mm-hmm.
right? Just because you find one minor error doesn't mean, oh man, the whole thing's wrong. No.
Mm-hmm.
So that objection doesn't work for a number of reasons.
Yeah, I've told people before, I said, have you ever made a 100 on a test?
Yeah,
and they kind of start smiling, and it's like, hey, look, yes, men do make mistakes, but it's like you said at the very beginning of your response, we don't always make mistakes, and
that's right.
And I think that's an important one to look at. Okay, now here's one, and I got to be honest with you, Frank, I've scratched my head over this one because it just doesn't seem to it doesn't make sense to me why this objection is even thrown out, but I've heard it so many times, I just feel compelled to bring it, make it part of our podcast today. And that's
this is number 4 now, right?
Yeah. We're on number four. We're on number 4 here.
Okay, all right.
The books of the Bible were not decided until the Council of Nicaea, when they were mandated by the Emperor Constantine.
Okay. First thing I want to say is, what evidence do you have for that? Because there is no evidence for that. You know better than I do, Brady, because you're more of a student of history than I am. In fact, the Council of Nicaea had nothing to do with what books were in the mm-hmm. Bible. That's from Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code book. That's
yep.
not the truth, right? In fact, what they were discussing at the Council of Nicaea, if I remember correctly, is what was the true nature of Christ's divine yeah. nature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were trying to figure that out. You had Arius going up against Athanasius, and Athanasius won the day. It had nothing to do with what books were in the Bible. In fact, as we point out in the book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, 25 of the 27 books of the New Testament are quoted by early church fathers, people I believe like Irenaeus mm-hmm. and others, by about 108 AD.
Mm-hmm.
So very early. In fact, let me find that exactly. Throw in your comment that we were talking about this before the air, about the other council of
yeah.
Laodicea there. Go ahead. I'm looking for this here.
Yeah, I'll give you some time here. So what's interesting, and this is why it blows my mind, is because the actual 27 books of the New Testament were not actually put in a list, a canon, if you will. They were not put on that list until the Council of Laodicea in 363 AD. And even then, the whole Council of Nicaea, this is an issue of history. That, of course, as Frank, as you just mentioned, you know, the big thing was Jesus of the same substance or a similar substance of God? You know, is he the same thing as God, or is he just kind of like God? But the other issues that were, they were there, and there was about 300 church leaders. It wasn't the entire Christian world, and here's where the other two items: church discipline, and what day do we celebrate Easter or the resurrection on? That was the big thing of the council. I mean, these were the things that they voted, and this is an established thing in history. And I appreciate that you're about to go to these, how many of the early church fathers mentioned it, because some people may hear, well, 363 that's even later than 325.
Right.
This is even worse. And what we have to understand, and I hope I'm not stealing your thunder on this answer.
No, go.
Is that the books of the New Testament, largely, I mean, the Gospels and the Pauline Epistles, so that's 17 of your 27 books, were never at any time in any of these councils ever under question. And that's so anyway, Frank, I'll turn it back over to you.
Well, one other thing about councils, what we need to remember is that councils really were illegal until the early 300s when mm-hmm. Constantine made Christianity tolerable, okay, mm-hmm. which I think was about 311, Edict of Milan,
yeah,
right? Yep. So before that, you could be executed for being a Christian. In fact, that's what Diocletian was trying to do just before Constantine. He's trying to wipe out every manuscript and wipe out a lot of Christians. So it wasn't like they could go down to their local Hilton and convene a Bible conference and let's discuss, you know, how many books are in the New Testament and all that. That was pretty much illegal for the first 280 or so years of Christianity, on and off, given different persecutions. But that's not even the point anyway. It wasn't Irenaeus. Irenaeus came later. I always get Irenaeus confused with Ignatius, okay? Mm-hmm. But right here on page, this is page 236 of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. Ignatius, writing from Smyrna in Asia Minor by about 107, lists about 25 of the 27 books of the New Testament as he is quoting them. In other words, Clement lists a bunch of them. He lived in 95 AD. That's Clement of Rome. Polycarp, about 110 AD, lists a whole number of them anyway, mm-hmm. as if they're authoritative, okay? Yeah. So it wasn't a mystery as to what was in the so-called canon. There were a couple of books that they did question, quite obviously. Mm-hmm. Revelation, although it's mm-hmm. quoted by Ignatius very early, was one. I think, let's see, what's here? There's could be one missing here that I'm trying to discover. Oh, 2 Thessalonians isn't listed here, okay. So there were a few that it wasn't listed or there was some question about, but I think it was Bruce Metzger who put it this way. Bruce Metzger was the top manuscript scholar of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. He taught at Princeton University. He was a believer. He mentored one of his most famous students. He mentored was Bart Ehrman, who turned mm-hmm. out to be not a believer. But it's interesting that both Ehrman and Metzger agreed that the New Testament doctrine can be found in what we now know as the New Testament. In other words, even though Ehrman wrote misquoting Jesus, he doesn't believe that you can't know what the New Testament writer said. He does believe you can know what the New Testament writer said, but I digress. Anyway, the point here is that they're quoting the New Testament as authoritative very, very early because they knew who. Or they knew what? They knew in order to be a writer of the New Testament, you either had to be an eyewitness of the resurrection or somebody that was confirmed through miracles by another eyewitness, like Luke. He was confirmed by Paul, okay? Mm-hmm. So the writers of the New Testament are all either eyewitnesses or people that knew eyewitnesses who could verify them. Yeah. So it's not a mystery that what should be in the New Testament.
No, not at all. And I've had students ask me before. I teach at Arlington Baptist University, and they've asked me. They said, "Okay, but why are we waiting so long to get the list?" And I said, "Listen, I go when everybody knows what's authoritative, and everybody knows what you know mm-hmm. what we think of as the Bible or the New Testament is." I said, mm-hmm. "There's no reason." I said, "The only reason why you had these issues pop up is because heresy began to creep in, and I mean, when you look at it, it's pretty awesome that it took as long as it did, which was, you know, into about midway through the second century before we started seeing, the Marcion heresy begin to creep in. So that's a good point.
And one other quick point on this, Brady, that I think we should mention. You mentioned when heresy starts creeping in. You know the Gospels that even Dan Brown talks about, like Gospel of Peter, Gospel of Judas, Gospel of Mary mm-hmm. Magdalene, whatever, you know, Gospel of Thomas. Mm-hmm. All of those names are names of eyewitnesses, right? But they're yeah. forgeries that are written 100 years, at least 100 years after those people have died.
Yeah.
Now, why would people say, this is from Thomas, or this is from Mary Magdalene, or this is from Peter, because they know that those names carry authority with them.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's the interesting thing. See, it wasn't a mystery that what should have been in the New Testament documents should have been written by people who were there. That's why the forgeries that come later try and steal the names of authoritative people and put them on their documents.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a backhanded compliment to say that the people of God knew that what ought to be in their New Testament are books written by people who were there, or people that knew people who were there. Mark is confirmed by Peter. Luke is confirmed by Paul, that kind of thing. And if you were making up gospels, wouldn't you use names like Peter and Paul rather than Mark and Luke?
Yeah.
You would if you're making them up, but they're not making them up.
Exactly. And I like the fact that you pointed out earlier in your response that Constantine made Christianity tolerable. There's so many people who want to say, well, that's when Constantine made Christianity the religion. It's like, slow down there. Let's look back at the history and the evidence and see what's there. But thank you for adding that in too.
Sure.
All right, here we go. We're moving on. This is the fifth one. We're looking at, I don't want to call them the 10 top objections, but 10 most popular objections that I've heard lately. And this is one I know that you've wrote about a lot, and that's this. I've heard this said before: there's no evidence for God. Science has disproven God's existence. Besides, how can we even know that God exists?
All right, let me stop right here. And when someone says there's no evidence for God, my first question is, what do you mean by evidence? Mm-hmm. And number two, why is there evidence for anything? Forget God.
Yeah.
Why is there evidence for anything? Now, how do you answer that? It turns out that when atheists say this, they're assuming that the world should be orderly and that our minds should be able to detect an orderly world, right? That we ought to be able to gather evidence and draw valid conclusions about reality outside of our skulls, right? Mm-hmm. That's what they're assuming.
Yeah.
Well, what best explains a reality that's orderly, that where there's reliable cause and effect, and what best explains the fact that we can ascertain those truths about the real world, discover them through our senses, and draw conclusions about the real world that are valid and true? Not atheism. Atheism thinks we're just molecular machines, that we're just moist robots, that every thought we have is the result of the laws of physics. Well, if that's the case, we can't even do science, right? We can't do science if we're just molecular machines. If we can't follow the evidence where it leads, we can't even do science. So science itself presupposes order, cause and effect, reliability, and our ability to know this cause and effect, this reliable cause and effect. And that's best explained by theism, not necessarily Christianity. We don't know if it's the Christian God, but it's best explained by an immaterial world that's orderly. It's best explained by ultimate reality being a mind. So as soon as they start bringing science up, I want to ask them, why? What do you mean by evidence, and why is there evidence for anything? Why is it, Brady, that if we put two parts hydrogen and one part oxygen together today, we're going to get water? And why do we think that if we do that tomorrow, we'll also get water? Why? Yeah. Because there's an orderly world where hydrogen and oxygen bond together and they give you water in the appropriate quantity and all this. Mm-hmm. That is the result of order. If tomorrow you put two parts hydrogen and one part oxygen together and you didn't get water, you got, you know, carbon or, you know, some other element or molecule or whatever, you go, well, this isn't very orderly. What's going on here? Okay. Yeah. So the whole thing presupposes, the whole scientific endeavor presupposes a mind, that there's order behind the world. In fact, I'm going to talk about this week on our podcast. I don't have enough faith to be an atheist podcast. What's the easiest way to show that God exists? So let me just answer that real briefly, because that's really where the question goes. The reason we know God exists, the short answer is, it's because it's the best explanation of reality. But the more detailed answer is because there are effects that are best explained by a cause known as God.
Mm.
In other words, we understand God by his effects. We don't see God directly. We see God by his effects. We see a creation That's the effect. We reason back to a cause, a creator. We see design in the universe, the fine tuning of the universe, the design of life. Those are the effects. We reason back to a cause, a designer. We have a moral law written on our hearts. That's the effect. We reason back to a moral law giver. So we know God by his effects. If the universe is an effect, and it is, even atheists are admitting that space, time, and matter had a beginning out of nothing. The question is, what could have caused space, time, and matter to come into existence? The effect is space, time, and matter. What could the cause be? The cause must be spaceless, timeless, immaterial. You say, why? Because space, matter, and time didn't exist. So whatever created space, matter, and time can't be made of space, matter, and time. And so the cause must be spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful to create the universe out of nothing, personal in order to choose to create, because to go from a state of nothingness to a state of creation, someone had to make a choice, and only persons can make choices. Mm-hmm. Impersonal forces can't make choices. Also, the being would have to be intelligent in order to have a mind to make a choice. And so I always ask people, I say, here is the cause of the effect that we call the universe. The cause must be spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, personal, and intelligent. What does that sound like? And people will typically say God, and then I'll say yes, and then they'll say, well, how do you know it's the Christian God? And the answer is, we don't yet. We haven't done enough research yet. You don't get the Christian God from just the cosmological argument, which is the argument I just gave, basically, that the universe had a beginning, so it must have a beginner. But you get a being that could be the Christian God, a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, personal, intelligent creator. If you then go look at the evidence for Jesus and you realize he rose from the dead, then you can draw the conclusion that the same being that walked out of the tomb 1,988 years ago is the same being in whose divine nature created the universe out of nothing. So you know God by his effects, and because this is a reality of reliable cause and effect, we can know God exists.
Very good, very good. One of the things that you have in your book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, that I have always found to be extremely helpful to remember is the SURGE acronym. In that when we look at this world, I mean, there's, like you said, there's a plethora of evidence. I mean, it's, you know, listen, God knew what he was doing when he gave us Romans 1, you know, when he gave us, you know, Psalm 19 1. And so we, you know, you had the second law of thermodynamics, the expanding universe, the radiation afterglow, the great galaxy seeds, and Einstein's theory of relativity, and all these things pointing back to the fact, and like you said, working from working from cause or from the effect back to the cause, no other explanation. What would you say, though? I'm just kind of thinking about this for those who want to try to accuse a God of the gaps type argument.
I would say, first of all, that the God of the gaps is a valid problem for some explanations. Like, for example, we used to think, oh, thunder, the gods must be bowling, you know, that kind of thing, right? Now we figured out, well, there's a natural cause for thunder and lightning and these kind of things. So the gods must be mad at us, okay? So it has been used illegitimately in the past, but there's no God of the gap for the beginning of the universe. It's not that we just have a gap in our knowledge and we're just gonna plug God in. It's not just that we lack a natural explanation for the creation of the universe. It's that the creation of the universe is positive, empirically verifiable evidence for a supernatural cause to the universe. Why do I say supernatural? Because if all nature had a beginning, then it can't be that nature is the cause. Nature is the effect. So nature can't be the cause. There must be something beyond nature, something supernature, that brought it into existence. So it's not a gap in our knowledge. There's not a natural law that's going to come by and somehow explain where all natural laws came from, right? Because where all of nature came from, nature itself is the effect, so it can't be the cause. It's got to be something beyond nature, something supernature. Same thing is true when you look at, say, the genetic code in human in DNA, and not just human DNA, but any DNA. You realize it's a message. You also realize that messages only come from minds. And so when you see, for example, in the sand, John loves Mary, it's not just that you lack a natural explanation for a natural cause. I mean, you know, no natural cause is going to create John Loves Mary in the sand. Mm-hmm. But that's positive, empirically verifiable evidence for an intelligent human being that wrote John Loves Mary in the sand. The same thing is true with the genetic code. That DNA is like John Loves Mary, except it's 3.2 billion letters long. So it's got to require a mind. And by the way, when people say, well, natural laws can do X or Y, first of all, laws don't do anything. Laws just describe what happens when left to themselves. But even if you were to grant that, that natural forces do certain things, natural forces themselves are an effect. Mm-hmm. They had a beginning, and B, they have to be sustained. Why doesn't the law of gravity change every 10 minutes?
Yeah.
Because there's a mind behind it. That's why.
Exactly.
You know. Exactly. So if they're gonna punt back to natural laws, they still have to explain the origin and the consistency currently of natural laws. How do you explain that?
Exactly. All right, well, we're about halfway through, so we're going to go ahead and put an end to this episode today, and we'll look forward to seeing all of our listeners again next week on Apologetics Profile. So I want to thank our guest today, Dr. Frank Turek, and I am Brady Blevins, and I look forward to seeing you again next week as we continue on this topic.
If you've enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe to the Apologetics Profile podcast on Podomatic. You can also support the podcast by becoming a patron at patreon.com/watchmanfellowship today.